Well, as we march right into spring, WWNO has three stories of renewal for you on this week's edition of All Things New Orleans. We hope you'll stay tuned to hear how a mid-city bartender, the Art Council's Director of Public Art, and the most beautiful man in the world are all contributing to this city we call New Orleans. Welcome to All Things New Orleans, WWNO's weekly news magazine that examines news, culture, and commentary from all corners of our region. I'm Katie Carraway in for Jack Hopke. This past weekend, New Orleans adopted resident Brad Pitt hosted a star-studded gala to benefit the Make It Right housing development taking shape in the Lower Ninth Ward. Before hosting the fundraiser, Pitt spent a few minutes with WWNO reporter Eileen Fleming to review the status of the project. They spoke in one of the neighborhood houses under construction.
For my meeting with Brad Pitt for a 15-minute interview, I drove as instructed to a nearly completed home in the Make It Right neighborhood in the Lower Ninth Ward. Security allowed me in, and I was shown to an empty back room where Brad Pitt was sitting by himself behind a bare, simple, fold-out table.
It is nice and echoey in here because this is a brand new...
They're so airtight that, you can't hear. Claiborne's right there, and you can't hear it.
My first question was, when was the last time you were here, and what do you think of the changes that you've seen here now?
We've been, trying to bring a film here every year, and last time I spent extensive time was last spring, where we shot a film here, and then I buzzed through in the fall to check on things, kind of an in-and-out kind of trip, and every time I come back, you get to see the neighborhood grow a little bit more, and coming over the Claiborne Bridge is my favorite sight.
Apparently that's quite the tourist attraction as well. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I feel for the neighborhood. I wish they could profit from it some way or have tours or something. But they've been, when we started this thing, we said we hated it if we brought in a circus. And he said the neighborhood's response was it's already a circus. So I'm not sure how they deal with it, or if it's actually a positive thing, because this is such an emblem of change and survival and resilience and putting your life back together and putting together in a new way. So I'm sure it's a push-pull.
Have you been around to other projects, other housing developments, such as Habitat for Humanity, and what are your thoughts on those?
Yeah, I'm a big fan of Habitat for Humanity. I've volunteered before with Habitat Humanity. I love what they do. And they build a mass quantity of homes. They get a lot of people in, and the spirit of working together to build them with the families, it's an amazing venture with great success. This project here was after something different, or we're after something different, and that is, how do we define our neighborhoods for the future? If buildings are 45% of our pollution, if affordable housing is built with toxic materials that where kids are plagued with asthma and run up their health bills and utility bills and almost keep people in a low-income trap, does it have to be that way just because we've been doing it that way for so long? So we wanted to see, and with the community here, if we could build... For the same amount of money, we could drive the price down, but build a house that was a home of dignity, a dignity for the family, their paycheck, their health, their kids' future. And it has been, we've had amazing, amazing results. And I think this goes so much further beyond just one neighborhood. I mean, already this place that suffered great horror and historically was marginalized is now the most high performing, healthy, greenest neighborhood in the country, and I think that's a message that needs to get out. There is no reason we need to build any other way now. And you'll see, you'll talk to these families whose utility bills were once $300 are now $28, $12, sometimes $7. It's an amazing story.
You started, I think, was it 2007 you came down and then thought, yeah, all right, we're going to do 150 homes, is that correct?
I came down first a few months after the hurricane and worked on a smaller project with Global Green, and then we expanded the idea here and got it going in 07. So this is what we see now is 4 years of intense focus and families determined to come home, and I can't wait to see what the next 4 years are going to bring.
I think you've got 80, about 80 now?
Yeah. Uh-huh. A few others under construction.
I think you wanted at the beginning, I think you said that it would, this will take a couple of years. Was that naive? Is it more complicated than you had imagined?
It is so much more complicated than I ever imagined. And yes, it was a complete naivete. And if I had seen all the roadblocks and all the hurdles we'd have to get across, it probably would have looked too daunting. But we've had great people who believe in what we're doing here and solve these problems one by one, and great solutions come out of them, actually. So, our initial pledge was 150 homes. We're not leaving after that. We're here, and we want to see how far this can grow.
You're moving on to Kansas City, I believe, and to New Jersey, and folks are like, oh no, is he leaving?
No, it's not moving on at all. It's things we're going to be able to do simultaneously. This is, as I say, what we've learned here, we can't keep it a secret. It's too big a news, and it can benefit too many people. I mean, imagine if all our homes are built under these mandates. I mean, these are homes that are producing more energy at times than they're consuming, that are not built with toxic materials, the social impact of this neighborhood alone is much more far-reaching than we even understand at this point. And we need to share that knowledge. As I'm telling you, this is a very special neighborhood. There's no other neighborhood like it in the U.S. And we need to get that message out. But no, we're not. Absolutely, we're not leaving. What's interesting, there are many areas here in the U.S. and even globally that we're also expanding into Ethiopia, doing a TB clinic under the mandates of MIR. But there is money in place in other parts of the world that are already have these building plans. And so we can come and say, let's do it this way with money that's already allocated. The Ninth Ward was built on literally the donations and kindness of strangers who were all felt moved by what we saw after the levee breaks.
I want to give you a chance to answer critics that have said about the project, the houses are too expensive and they're taking too long. Any thoughts on that?
Again, we're trying to build a new paradigm. And these homes are, of course, the first prototypes are going to be more expensive. And then with each one we build, we're getting the price down, and we knock them down. And I'm telling you, we are building them now at a competitive price. But what you also, it's just not dollars for donuts. What you also have to understand is what I was speaking about earlier, of the social impact of these kind of neighborhoods. They don't contribute to global warming. They don't pollute the environment. Just the savings in our offcuts on what we put very little in the dumpster for landfills, which is very, very expensive and toxic. We're driving health bills down, which is a burden on all of us, because we all foot that bill. And these homes will last longer. And if there were to be another storm at the degree of Katrina, these homes will still be standing here. They're rated for that kind of storm, which means, you know, repair bills will be less. We have to really do a cost analysis, but it is certainly not a dollar for donuts, so to speak. And we're trying something new, so it takes a little longer. But again, what I think the impact 50 years from now, when we're building everything this way, we'll look back at this time and realize the stake we put in the ground was a revolutionary moment, and I believe that.
And then you're an international citizen, you're around the world. Are you feeling or are you hearing any Katrina fatigue? Because it's been a long time since that storm and other things have happened. Are people tired of hearing about New Orleans in other areas?
No, I don't think it's New Orleans specific. I think that, we've had a beleaguered economy, and people are in difficult times. We've also gone through tornadoes and nuclear reactors, tsunamis, and there's been a lot of catastrophic events since. I don't see it as fatigue of care and spirit and feeling for others. I see it simply as people are depleted in their own lives and having a difficult time on their own, and with the mortgage crisis. And until we get this economy back on, it's going to be, it's going to be slim givings.
And this project is, I think, what you're saying also, that it's going to expand internationally as well and take the technology here and move it to other places?
To expand it, to the seed that was planted here, to plant more seeds in other areas. Because I am telling you, this is a new paradigm, and there is no reason to build it any other way.
Okay. Oh, I have one more question that I have to ask you. I understand that you studied journalism in school.
Uh-huh. I studied journalism at the University of Missouri, but I didn't graduate.
And then you moved on to acting.
That I did. I loaded up my car and moved to, not Beverly Hills, but Burbank.
And so my question is, how's it working out for you?
There are ups and downs, but I'm going to stick with it, and we'll see what happens.
Thank you, sir.
All right, thanks.
Eileen Fleming is a reporter for WWNO. Her stories can be heard during Morning Edition, All Things Considered, and All Things New Orleans. And the features you hear tonight are not just available over the airwaves, but also online. If you ever want to listen again or catch up on our programming, we archive all our features at WWNO.org. The continuing renewal and development of our city will be demonstrated artistically this spring and summer in a partnership between the New Orleans Arts Council and local public library branches. WWNO's Jack Hopke got interested and tracked down a key individual for details.
Morgana King, welcome. Glad to have you here at WWNO.
Thank you. Great to be here.
You are the Director of Public Works for the Arts Council. Is that correct?
Or I'm the Director of Public Art.
Director of Public Art. What does that entail, Morgana?
The primary thing is that the Arts Council for 25 years has administered the Percent for Art program. We place public art in city facilities. So anytime there's a new capital bond sale, we receive 1% of that money to do public art. It includes everything from sculptures you see in the neutral ground to paintings in offices in City Hall, all kinds of range of pieces.
And you have put some of that funding toward a relationship now with the New Orleans Public Library. How did that work out?
The library buildings were going to be the first buildings completed from the new design-build process that the city worked with after Katrina, and the Percent for Art Committee, which decides where the funding is spent from our program, decided that the partnership between the Arts Council and the public libraries would have a great community impact and really be able to align with the city's priorities.
We have, I understand, a number of public libraries to open very soon. How are you tied in with that?
There's four brand new buildings opening around the community, and there's one renovation project. So the renovation of Rosa Keller Library and Community Center is going to be the first opening.
This is going to be tomorrow, I understand.
March 16th at 2:30, Rosa Keller Library in Broadmoor neighborhood.
So this is not all a simultaneous opening. They're staggered.
Right. It's all happening pretty soon.
I'm sure that there's a site where people can find out about these individual events, but let's take this step by step. Now, how did you go about selecting the artists and the type of art that would be involved?
We run a open call to artists, and it was an advertisement around the fall of 2010 to ask artists to submit their qualifications. And then I had a committee of community members, of people recommended by the library staff and by the Percent for Art Committee, community members and artists and art experts to review those applications.
So you've selected five. You've got five openings?
The signature artwork commission was actually four artists and four buildings, and then we are have a piece that was commissioned through the same process pre-Katrina, and that is finally having its chance to have an opening with the renovation of Keller Library.
Let's mention these artists. These seem like deserving people. I mean, there were some, as I read very briefly a press release about this, there were some appreciable funds expended doing this program.
Great. The first artist is Janice Cartier, and she's going to have a commissioned watercolor that's kind of a swampscape piece in the Keller Library.
How does that piece fit that particular place?
Well, if you've ever researched the history of New Orleans, you know that some areas were originally swampland that were drained. And Broadmoor neighborhood is one of those spaces that was underwater and...
It's quite recently, as a matter of fact, unfortunately.
So it's kind of ironic that we're getting this piece back in that building after Katrina, because it was a homage to the landscape that almost returned and took over.
Okay, what about the rest of these talented people?
The next opening is at the Norman Mayer branch in Gentilly, and that is an artist named Ron Theron Ratliff. He is works with the Yaya program and is a native New Orleans artist who's come up through that Yaya program and is actually their artistic director now. Next is the Smith Branch Library with artist Robert Warrens for the Lakeview Library that has eight acrylic paintings. Jeff Whipple, he's an artist from Florida who came to New Orleans and did portraits with community members in New Orleans East. Next we have the... Algiers Regional Library is going to be opening a little later this summer. They're still under construction, but when that piece gets finished, it's a glass hanging, and it's by artist Michelle Gutlove, and it's going to be really beautiful.
Morgana King, who is the Director of Public Art for the Arts Council of New Orleans. Morgana, thank you very much for your work and for coming to visit us.
Thank you so much.
Further information about opening ceremonies and the artists and their works may be found at www.artscouncilofneworleans.org. For many New Orleanians, the epicenter of St. Patrick's Day is located at a particular bar in Mid-City. Of course, had Stephen Patterson not worked diligently to reestablish the neighborhood tavern, this might not be the case. Sharon Litwin brings us the story for this week's Notes from New Orleans.
In New Orleans, we have long since had a neighborhood called the Irish Channel. This area, close to the Mississippi River, was where so many hard-working Irish and Irish-American families lived in the early days of this city. If one had to identify an Irish or Irish-American neighborhood these days, you might have to say Mid-City. It's here that a special watering hole attracts expats, those of Irish extraction, and those who wish they were. And as we inch closer to that one special day when everyone is Irish, Finn McCool's is the center of the universe.
Well, St. Patrick's Day every year, that's the biggest day of the year for us. It's evolved over the years. It's just got bigger and bigger. We try and celebrate being Irish and also, very importantly, being Irish in America. And New Orleans has a very, very strong Irish tradition, being one of the biggest ports of entry to the United States for Irish back in the 1800s. So we didn't know that when we first came here, but we've definitely become a part of it.
The we is Stephen Patterson and his wife Pauline. These Belfast, Northern Ireland natives own Finn McCool's, an authentic style Irish pub. Celebrating St. Patrick's Day is, of course, the highlight of their year. But it's a little different from the way the Pattersons celebrated in Ireland.
Well, where I came from in Belfast, I grew up during the 70s and 80s. There was no big St. Patrick's Day celebration, as it were. Ireland was in the middle of the Troubles. And to come to New Orleans, it's a completely different cup of tea, so it's great. So St. Patrick's Day, as I'd said earlier, it gets bigger and bigger every year. So we actually started last year by having a block party. We close off the street to traffic so everybody's safe. We're going to have live Irish music. And one of the things we celebrate is because Ireland is the land of saints and scholars. We have a short story competition where we try and get as many people to write a short story, not necessarily about Finn McCool's, but about life in New Orleans and life about being an Irish-American. And we publish those short stories. So it gives people something else to do on St. Patrick's Day besides just drinking and having a good time, although that's a very important part of it.
The Pattersons are the quintessential example of people who came to New Orleans first for a vacation and then returned to the Big Easy to live.
I came here 22 years ago in the summer of 1990 with my wife Pauline, and we both worked in Irish pubs in different parts of the city. I worked downtown in the Quarter, where there was a much more touristy Irish pub feel. My wife worked in mid-city, which was much more working class, local Irish people coming in, Irish born, Irish Americans, and New Orleans people, carpenters, electricians, etc. So we got to see both sides of the Irish American life in New Orleans. After we were here for 12 years, we came across a little rundown pub in mid-city and we took it over. And in 2002, we opened Finn McCool's Irish Pub on Bank Street.
The Pattersons' vision of their establishment is one that extends further than simply serving beer and drinks to local folk.
Well, our philosophy was to be very community orientated. Finn McCool's is definitely all about the customers. It's a very working class pub. It reminds me of working men's pubs in Belfast. It has actually been a bar on that corner for over 100 years. So I've had guys come in and tell me this is the first bar they went into after they came back after the Second World War. After they got back after the Korean War, they came whenever it was a bar. So they're very happy that it's continued to be a bar, and they say it's in good hands now.
Many members of the Pattersons' extended family have moved to New Orleans to be with them, and they, in turn, have dedicated themselves to their neighborhood.
We actually reopened the bar on St. Patrick's Day 2006, which was about 6 or 7 months after the storm. So that was a great milestone for us, and that's also something that is personal to Finn McCool's, and we celebrate that every year. And a lot of people that helped us reopen come back every year and celebrate with us.
For more information about Finn McCool's and the St. Patrick's Day celebration, go to wwno.org or nolavie.com. For WWNO, I'm Sharon O'Litman.
Finn McCool's is located at the corner of Bank Street and South Telemachus in Mid-City, and more information is available online at finnmccools.com. And that's going to do it for the March 15th edition of All Things New Orleans. A reminder that you can listen to and interact with all of our featured stories on WWNO.org. Many thanks to executive producer Paul Mawson and associate producer Thomas Walsh for putting together tonight's program. I'm your host, Katie Carraway. Fresh Air is coming up next at 7 o'clock.